introduction here, which is this is Karen Brewster, and it's September 6th, 2025. And I'm here with Mark Nordman at his beautiful home at Denali National Park. Thank you, Mark, for making some time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So this is for the Iditarod National Historic Trail Project Jukebox. And before we get into the trail questions itself, let's do a little bit about your background and
Sure, absolutely.
How you got to Alaska.
Yeah, I'm originally from northern Minnesota. I was born and raised in Duluth, Minnesota. Ended up getting out of school there, and always had such an interest in the north. And so I moved up to the Canadian border, spent a winter there by myself, caretaking a little lodge cabin outfit. Had my first introduction to sled dogs, and through a fellow named Tim White, who's kind of was my mentor. We made a trip up here in 1976, I believe, to work on a to run a sled dog race, and I was his handler. We went to the Northwest Territories first, and we all have our stories about how we first got to Alaska, but that's for another day. Came up here, I ran my first Iditarod in 1983. I went back home. We started another race in the Midwest called the John Berger's Race. Me and four or five other guys worked on that. And from there, I started coming back and forth, ran my first race in 83, as I said, did some officiating in 1988 as a race judge, and then took over the race marshal's job in 1989. I was still living in Minnesota, coming up every year for the race. I went through some changes on the home front, and my partner Denise Elbert, who actually worked Iditarod for 16 years as a race veterinarian, we moved up here, and my first real employment outside of being race marshal with Iditarod was their village relations coordinator. So I spend a lot of time to this day off the road system in all our villages along the Yukon and Kuskokwim and the coast on the way to Nome. So got done.
And what that coordinator, that the Iditarod Trail Committee,
yeah,
is who that positions with?
Yeah, that was at that time. Stan Hooley was our executive director. He hired me on as village relations coordinator. You know, we show up in all these villages and we use all their facilities and we want to make sure we're welcome. So it's that's been a real good ride. And then when I moved up here in 2003, we lived in a wall tent on the property you're at for a year, and then into the garage, and then into our log home here. So, and shortly after 89, I was continued to do the race marshalling, we'll say, and then I took a position with full-time contract work with Iditarod as their race director, and I still hold that role today. So okay. I'm 71 as of March 4th. I still got a few more years.
Yeah.
And I always tell people I'll be raking straw, taking care of sled dogs when I'm 90 in Caltech.
So. You're going to be like Norm Vaughn, right? You're going to be out there at age 90, whatever it was.
I'll be doing something something for Iditarod for sure. It's been my passion. It's allowed me to travel all over the world, from southern Argentina to putting on sled dog race, to Europe, to Scandinavia, all over North America.
How did you get so interested in dog mushing?
I ran into it in 75. I happened to be at a sprint race in Duluth, Minnesota, and I found it very interesting. I just stumbled upon it. The next year I volunteered, and that's, George Atlin, Roland Lombard, they were all coming down and racing at the time, and so I just kind of fell in love with it and never really raced around dogs per se, but I think the connection with the winter and the north and travel, it really took an interest. And then Tim and I came up in 76.
And so you said, yeah, you ran the race in 83. Have you continued to run it? Or once you became marshal, you didn't run it anymore?
I actually did. I've run it five times. One time I scratched, but I've been able to complete the race four different times. And I think that's really helped me, even that bum race I had, as race marshal, race director, because I know how things can go really good and really bad. So Yeah, so I, and then, like I said, moved up here in 2003 and had dogs till about 5 years ago up here, just more recreational. We did a bunch of research projects with Dr. Davis out of Oklahoma for the NIH and DARPA. We had big treadmill here, and once I was done with it, Ali Zirkel and even more so Martin Boozer really took over the program.
So that was research on the health of sled dogs?
No, it was actually the first on the NIH grant. That was for why are some of our athletes, it's been a while trying to remember it all, but some of our biathlons, pro skiers, Olympic caliber skiers, mm-hmm. cold weather and asthma. How can these dogs not have a problem at 40 below as long as they're taken care of with good nutrition? And then the DARPA study, that actually Mr. Swenson, mm-hmm. kind of the my hero of Iditarod to this day, we hired him to do a trial out on the Denali Highway. And that was actually for the military. It's there again, why can these dogs run 100 miles in December, 200-300 in January, end of February, run the Quest, run the Iditarod, go to the Kobuk 440, which is a race I still work today, do all these races, and how come they don't, my term would be breakdown? How can we make a better soldier? So it's been real interesting. With my partner, Denise, she did a lot of work with the, as a veterinarian, with the research scientists that came up for that. So
neat.
It's been a good ride.
Yeah, and so when did you get involved with the Iditarod Trail Alliance?
I knew you were going to ask me that. I should have looked it up. I want to say maybe 12 years ago.
Okay.
I wasn't there at the beginning, but it's a seat that actually is set aside for the Iditarod Trail Committee.
Okay.
So I'm kind of their representative. They've been wonderful to the dog race, funding trail projects, helping us make sure we have a safe trail to Nome, promoting the history of it. I have a rookie meeting the first weekend, end of November, first part of December, that I have all the rookies coming in. So I think it really surprises people coming from not just Iowa and Argentina or Norway, but even in Alaska here, how much history there really is behind the trail. You know, we put together this DVD that gives you, you mentioned Dan Seavey before mm-hmm. we got started, Lee Pileski, Judy Bittner, all those people, they are all involved with that. And Kevin Keeler, of course, has been such a great representative of the trail. I'm sorry to say he's retired from BLM, but we miss him. He's a wealth of information.
Yes, well, I have interviewed him, so.
Yes, I saw that.
We have some of his knowledge anyway.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting, you know, with the rookie meeting and telling people about the history is, I think, most Alaskans even think the Iditarod Trail is because of the race. They don't realize that there was a history first.
I can't tell you the amount of different things. Even I remember one time sitting in our past executive director's office, and we got a call from Senator Stevens' office saying there was some money, and they wanted to know where to send the check, and we were like, what are you talking about? Well, here it was to the Forest Service for the trail. Uh-huh. So I think there is a lot of confusion. We complement each other really well, but that history is so important, and I'm really pleased that you're going up and you're putting this project together, because we, as we said before we started, we're losing so many things.
Right. Well, when in 1978, when the historic trail designation was made, revolved around that, I think it was in the early 80s, there was an oral history project done on sort of historic uses, like with some of the old miners and people like that. So those interviews also exist. And that's sort of different than this, is sort of the history of how the trail got designated and how it's being managed and what the Alliance has done. And
You know, it's so... You know, we have lost Lee Pileski and Dan Seavey, which, you know, the old guard of the trail, but we still have plenty of representation from that. And I think we find the same thing with the Iditarod race itself, trying to keep relevant from all of us that are living on our phones and not dreaming about going down the trail. All my connections with the elders and stuff. We talked about Tana Chief, the great project they've done with the recording of people and following their life story. And I think it's something that needs to continue because we are starting to slip a little bit. You know, we have the 10-year coffee table book. I don't know if you have that or not.
About the race?
Yeah, about the race, the original 10 years. If you don't, I'm sending you home with a copy.
Okay.
It's fabulous. And that's the same type of thing. That's, of course, in a printed something you can put your hands on,
right,
too. But
What about the work the Alliance has done? They've done some printed material.
Oh, yeah.
Is that helpful out on the...
It is. That's a great statement to make, because what I end up doing is every year, Judy Bittner and the crew, they put together all the information that has been printed. Talking about Goodwin, Hannah Motoro did some work on us, history pamphlets, small books, mm-hmm. DVDs. I take those and I take them every year. We take them into the checkpoints so our volunteers from all over the world can read them, but then they're left there so they can put them in the library of each individual school. So they've been a huge help, definitely in keeping the story alive of the trail, all the roadhouses and different things. And it's amazing to me when I get listening to these rookies after they see that, they're just blown away. You know, that, wow, we didn't realize we were traveling over something so historic. And I know some miners, and of course their fathers and grandfathers were involved with it. And you talk about flat and all the different areas and different places. You know, we only run one segment of the trail. There's all the feeders, of course.
Right.
That we...
There's certain parts where the historic trail takes a slightly different route than the race trail, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I'm surprised, especially the first third of it, you know. We go right over the range, right through Rainy Pass. I found a wonderful article one time talking about... going through Rainy Pass. For years, for my mushers, the biggest thing was get over the pass because weather could come in. And the trail marking is so light because it blows so hard up there. And with the amount of snow and everything, it's hard to keep the trail. And well, here back in the day, they were struggling with the same thing. And they lost some horses and some people were lost for days in Rainy Pass trying to keep that trail marking open and straight ahead, and I'm dealing with that today. It's that same area, so things have changed, but in many ways, traveling across this state, not a lot.
Right.
You're still dealing with weather and communities and everything.
How do you see the fact that it's a historic trail? Does that help with the race? I mean, is there a blending there, or does that hinder the race?
I think with the amount of work that IHTA has done with our whole board, it only helps. Hindering it, I see no conflict whatsoever. You know, we've had Leslie Schick and her partner there, I'm forgetting his name, sorry, that got the adjudication for the trail. Making sure
Ben.
No, Ben, I think, is here now. It's, I'll have to look that up.
No, yeah. I talked to her yesterday, so
yeah.
The name, Ben's name comes to mind.
Yeah, and Ben is right involved with it now, too. But
Larson.
Yeah.
Larson, is that his name? Anyway.
Yeah, well, so I think it's only been good. It's also helped me with economics. You know, we had a huge fire. 2010 Turquoise Lake fire, we'll call it, between Aron and Farewell, not the old burn that we always hear about on the trail itself, but this just devastated the trail. So with help from IHTA and the state of Alaska, only through Judy and Leslie working with the state, we were able to fund that. Private interest came in. Dave Cruz gave me some equipment and operators and huge support. We flew a Herc in with Linden Air Cargo just to keep that trail open, because you couldn't walk over it, let alone run a dog team over it. There was so much devastation after that fire.
Oh, so the fire that downed trees and
yes,
all that
yeah,
impacted
burned,
the trail?
It burned so hot that it just burned every bit of sap out of these black spruce, and they came down like pickup sticks for miles across there. So IHTA let the race go on. You know, we always have a presence at not just in the villages when I talked about our printed material, but we also have a presence at the restart, selling our John Van Zyl, who's been a great supporter of our sport, very well-known artist in this state. Huge help there. So they've been able to show up at the event, pass the word on. I think we now have a new executive director, which you probably heard.
Yep.
And I think that's going to be a big help, too, because Judy is retired, but still the real workaholic of this whole thing, along with some other board members, but she keeps this whole thing together.
Sure. Is there a membership for the Alliance, or is it just you guys on the board?
No, we have a board, but there is an actual membership. We're trying to enhance that all the time, just trying to get more people interested in it. You know, for a while we set up at the state fair. There was also a project that was done through IHTA. We had a log cabin, kind of a reenactment of a checkpoint cabin, of a safety cabin, we'll call it more, not so much checkpoint. Greg Bill, who's passed on, he was on the board and very instrumental in that. And now that's sitting out at the office at my 2.2 Connect Goose Bay Road. So that cabin with all its interior and all the old things that you'd find in a safety cabin is there for our many, many, many tourists that come through all summer. So it's been a good partnership. I think it can be better. That's my goal, as I slow down a little bit to try to get even more done within the race for IHTA.
So how do you think it could be better?
I think just more time for the Iditarod staff to understand our mission as IHTA. Just kind of continuing enhancing what this group has done for all these years, making people aware of it. So many people think of I can't tell you, it's half a dozen times a year somebody calls me personally and wants to hike the Iditarod Trail from Anchorage to, or from Seward to Nome, and I'm saying, well, you can get up to Anchorage, okay, but not too far after that, you're not. It's not a summer use trail.
Well, if they did it where they got to Anchorage by the winter, and then they could finish in winter.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's a lot that you can do, and we're trying to get, I mentioned earlier about, you know, I think of the young people, trying to get them involved, trying to get those rural villages and those kids that are too connected, as many of us are, to our devices and not really getting out and seeing what the state is all about.
Yeah, can you talk more about when the connections you've made in the villages and that work you've done?
Yeah, that still to this day is my passion about my being in Iditarod. I have friends all over the world, but my friends are off the road system in rural Alaska, my best friends, I think. Just the history, hardworking people, just the fact that they, and even more so now, I know in Caltag, I have good friends, the Ismelkas there, that Justin and his boys and daughters have really understood the trail. They work on the trail between what I'll call Caltag and Tripod Flats. There's a cabin out there that they help build, and so you see the young people. You know, I've got like three generations of people that have worked. Justin's father and Justin and Devon and Kenny, his boy, and his daughters, they all support us, as they do the Iron Dog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another, it's kind of, we're having meetings here shortly with the Iron Dog, too. But I think that people like to, quick example, when I go to work the Kobuk 440, and I come in, we start in Kotzebue, and we go up through Norvik, and then we make a loop, depends on what year it is, But you come to Norvik, and all the people are there. You show up with a dog team. You show up talking history, and those people just love it. And it's not just the 70-plus, you know, because these kids have all heard the stories, too. So that's what's going to keep everything alive.
Mm-hmm. And so in your example of, you know, like Kaltag or these villages where the trail goes through, do they feel ownership and pride as stewards, or how does that get developed?
I guess maybe to the last part of the question, how does it get, yes, definitely pride and ownership, but how does it get developed? Start a junior trail breakers. I've got six guys that put the trail in for me for the race. I call them Hell's Angels on Tracks, young guides friend of mine. Start a junior trail breakers club. Have those kids come out. Get involved. Take ownership of the trail. Trying to tell them that, you know, it's not just the serum run. That's kind of the, you know, we get confused. People think the Iditarod started for the serum run. Yes, it's a great thing to associate with, but we know it didn't start that reason. But just knowing that their ancestors, the Ryan family out of Unicleet, you know, Boyack and his the father, and Lee is his son. Boyack's father used to run mail from Unicleet up to Kaltag and back. And so when you have that connection of a family and a community, and of course they're with Ryanair, that really helps promote. And I think it's just making sure people take the time to ask those favors. You know, the Ryanair has been such a supporter of the race and the history because they lived it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was their grandfather, Lee's grandfather, that did all travel by dog team and knows the gold miners and knows the history of the Inupiaq and the Athabascan and the culture there.
And is it all volunteer, or do they get some compensation for their assistance?
For the race itself, we have a very small staff. I think I've all these years have just worked under a contract for my position. We do have some paid employees, but Iditarod would not happen without the volunteers. And that's not just people in South Central and people that come in from the lower 48 or New Zealand or wherever. Without the communities that come and cook meals for all of my staff and volunteers and, you know, judges and pilots. You know, we got 50 veterinarians and 25 pilots and 350 volunteers we send out to the checkpoints. It's all because they love to do it. I've always said it amazes me what would possess somebody to take their 2 weeks off for their vacation, working on an assembly line in Kansas, just to come up here and rake straw and tend to.
Well, and I was thinking, you know, people in the villages where life is so expensive that they, you know, the idea that they're doing something without getting financial compensation.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and that can be a concern, but what I make sure, let's use Nikolai for example. It's more important for me that everybody that goes cuts wood gets that 5 gallons of gas. My deal is I'll ask for your time, but it can't cost you anything. We send out a huge amount of checkpoint food. Secondary, all the mushers leave anything, all, you know, any food they have, snacks, whatever, and dog food is huge. We feed some of these villages all year long till the next year because all the dog food they don't use stays. And there's a lot of it. I tend to say there's probably as much dog food fed as is left.
Wow.
So, and you know, when you're paying $100 for a bag and $12 for a gallon of milk, you know the scene. It's,
right.
It's, and fuel. So we also do put, I think it was 2003, the first year I had to move the race to Fairbanks. It's a huge hit when we don't go through not just the commercial interests like Steve Perrins and the Perrins family, Rainy Pass Lodge, Winter Lake Lodge. You know, they have guests that book 2-3 years out. And the same, then you get into Nikolai, a smaller community, where my ashes are going to be built, dropped on the way in, favorite place on the trail. They've, and McGrath, it's their spring startup money. The Iditarod Trail Cafe, the Anoka Roadhouse, it really, really helps them. So we also, and then you have the tourists that fly along, and they're willing to spend big money for that bunk somewhere in somebody's home and have the meals, and the kids cook hamburgers for, the mushers can get them, but it's absolutely for so many people that follow, and major media too. So we work closely with the IHTA. I would be very disappointed if that ever was a split. I think one thing that can be improved on, we have an education program. IHTA has an education program. I think we're starting to try to mesh those together, but COVID kind of hurt IHTA and lack of funding at the time, but I think we're up step on that. So we need to continue to work together on, you know, I'm not saying we can't each have our own education programs, but really try to make it happen.
Yeah, well, so I know that benefit. About IHTAs, which is the iTrek, where they train teachers about how to, you know, do outdoor education using the trail. What's the ITC's education program?
Everything from the math scientists, from, you know, how many dogs going at this miles per hour, and you name it. We have Linda Fenton, Jim DePries. We have a program called Teacher on the Trail. I went to a conference they had down in Boise, Idaho, and it's a very competitive. You apply and you have to write papers to be selected. That person will then come in and embed themselves with everything for the race. Go to all the checkpoints, as many checkpoints as we can fly them to. And just pass on writing programs. There's a whole curriculum, much like IHTA too, mm-hmm. iTrek. But there's probably six or seven past educators that have been Teacher on the Trail that come back every year, that we have a summer conference, a winter conference. So.
And who pays for, that? Because to pay for a teacher to fly between checkpoints.
Well, that's all through ITC. You know,
you have the funding for that.
Yeah, and pretty much like any volunteer that comes up to work the race, outside of a few personal effects or certain snacks they like or whatever, they're totally all the lodging's taken care of, all the transportation.
Oh.
I spend $40,000 on checkpoint food that gets sent out. And that's not just for our people, that's for the community as we come into there.
Right. I assume that the volunteers have to fly themselves to the places they're working.
They need to get to Alaska.
Yeah.
But after that, everything is taken care of. Like I mentioned, I've got Alaska Air Transit, Ryanair, Desert Air flies all my dogs. But so all those people are supporters of the race. And
as I was going to ask, how do you fund these projects like Teacher on the Trail? You have the money, but where does that come from?
Sponsorship, our raffle, which we just finished up. You know, we'll make $800,000 off of the raffle every year.
Oh my gosh!
There's two different raffles, so and then corporate sponsorship, merchandise sales. That's a big deal at our headquarters there, and of course we always said. Peggy Farns was down in Seward this year and up at the Tanana Valley State Fair. Merchandise, raffle tickets. It's kind of like a lot of the way a lot of smaller nonprofits go, but we're a big nonprofit.
Right. Well, so. And I know there have been issues in the past with sponsors and
Lack
thereof.
Absolutely. Sponsors come and go. Of course, you know, there are people that don't like what we do, but I contend that we're doing much more for even some of the research stuff I mentioned mm-hmm. earlier. The Iditarod Trail Committee has done as much, if not more, for the health of pets at home. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the research. We lost Dr. Stuart Nelson. He passed away last fall. Was tragic for so many of us, mm-hmm. Such a good friend, and research projects there again with the idea of to help know what the sled dog is all about, but also about your helping your lab on the couch.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I maybe have this in another interview, but for the Trail Alliance, where is their funding? It comes from BLM?
It does, yeah. There's, minute amount of merchandise sales. But no, that's barely even worth bringing up. But it is through, we have a membership program. I'm hoping we can enhance on that. Stuff like this is going to bring people, the interview here today and others will bring people to the table and want to get more involved. But it's an agreement that we have with the federal government.
With BLM.
With BLM.
Yeah.
Right. And that funding, you know, you never know where that's at. So we're kind of, right now we're doing good.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got a couple trail projects I've been working on. We had another fire that came through, and so I'm going to go try to fly out and take a look at that, and then I'll be reaching out to them for money, and it's kind of passed through BLM.
Uh-huh. Well, the trail projects are important thing that IHTA does that relates to the race. So can you talk a little bit about some of those? You mentioned the safety cabins.
Yeah, the safety cabins for sure. But here's what I do. Whenever I go to the IH, it's not just for the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. It's for people that travel, either trapping or casual travel, families, village to village. I contend we would have had a hell of a time running the race after that last fire. Without them. Mm-hmm. So it's not just for the race. But every year we try to deal with, you know, time allows. My trail breakers go out 2 weeks before the race, first part of February, and they put in Dalzell Gorge. That's a place that we constantly have trouble with. And then they'll continue to work on other trail. Interesting side note, it used Bruce Lee, who's a very good friend of mine, one of the more senior, if not the most senior, park bus driver in National Park. Here's the deal. We get, you know, our growing season's so intense. But when spring comes a month earlier and fall takes longer to show up, that growing season is so intense that we're seeing more. You know, I used to be able to not send a crew out and brush an area for 3, 4, 5, 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And now it feels like you want to do it every other year just because of the alder, because of the, you know, climate change, whatever you want to call it. It's definitely obvious that things are growing faster.
Yeah.
And beetle kill. You know, we're dealing with that a lot now, that especially between Squetna checkpoint and Rainy Pass and now beyond, you know, that's just, and I hate to say it, but I've got it here.
Yeah.
It's just really started to show up this last year, so.
Well, and you mentioned the brushing out. So the trail breakers are the guys on the people on the snow machines going out and mm-hmm. putting in the trail, so to speak. But you have people who go out and brush it
I've hired locals mm-hmm. out of Nikolai, which was a big boost to the family there, the Runkle family and others, and we'll contract stuff out. Much like, you know, we have the, during Obama stimulus funds, we were able to build, IHTA was able to build these cabins,
mm-hmm.
or BLM was. And so they'll go out and use those, and then there's a group in McGrath, there's a group in Shagluck that are kind of, you're the caretaker of the cabin, the local groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that was very successful.
So your brushers and your trail breakers use those cabins?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know how much the mushers use them.
A couple of them are a little off the trail, but they're there more for a safety deal. Yeah, not a lot of mushers. Their mindset isn't to get too comfortable.
Right.
You get into a cabin and it's all hot and there's nobody around to wake you up.
Right.
But they're used, absolutely. There's one up in the Blueberries, up out of Uniclet. There's one before you get to Iditarod. There's one in the Carlson Creek Cabin, which is similar to that. There's one at the Big Yetna, which is just before Shagluck, and mushers will pull in there. And so, no, they're good. But they're mainly for if somebody really gets in trouble, It doesn't take much. All you need is a box shelter to get out of the wind.
Yeah, and how is the decision made where to put them? Is that based on a historic, there was a cabin here before?
I think maybe in a couple places, but I think it was more, and that was Mr. Keeler that really led the placement with a lot of research beforehand and huge expense. We all know helicopters cost so much to charter. And but I think it was a combination of Kevin reaching out to the right parties and what works for everybody.
Yeah. And so speaking of Kevin Keeler, who's the former trail manager or administrator, whatever, for BLM, kind of what is that, the role of that person? What do they, how does that connect with the trail and the villages and the race?
Yeah, I'd say he was kind of the liaison between all of them. You know, mile marking and signage. And some people love signage and some people say, I'm in the wilderness, so I don't want to see a sign. But definitely Kevin was instrumental in Roan is kind of the shining star of BLM. He was so heartfelt about taking care of that. And I'm sure still has the interest in it, even though not employed in that position anymore. But he would... And he'd travel. He'd go to Unicleet. He'd, you know, he'd have work. The sled dog race is permitted by BLM, and so they want to make sure everything's done right, and everything from litter and straw, which has always been a tough one for me because we have to have straw for our dogs, but we need to have, in you know, weed-free straw. I sit on the actual. It's crazy. I sit on the invasive weeds board. I'll call it. For the state of Alaska, we're one of the bigger users of that product. And I personally absolutely believe in it because we don't want to spread invasives across the state.
Right.
So depending on how my guys up in Delta do, we always try to buy local straw out of Delta.
And then
that's
does that
certified.
Does that straw get hauled back out?
No.
Or it stays?
It doesn't get hauled out. Anything extra will leave with the villages, and they'll use it with their dogs or their gardens or whatever. Otherwise, it's burned because dogs have been sleeping on it, and if there's any dog waste left, they'll burn it up and just clean it all up. And we're always trying to have cleans. A team comes in, and if I'm 2 days behind you, Karen, I would like to have fresh straw, so we always try to clean up where we're at.
Yeah, that's one thing I was wondering is about after everybody comes through, you know, on the trail and in the villages, what's the cleanup? Not just of straw, but everything else.
You know, and we've stumbled before where, you know, the weather's coming in and people want to get home, and I've done everything from make sure that people are they don't leave until everything's cleaned up, and or I'll give the basketball team in Nulato or Caltag, you know, I'll donate $500. Hey, kids, can you go clean that up for me? And they're of course happy. It's for their spring trips or flying to Fairbanks for tournaments. So there's a lot of interaction with the communities. That's what Iditarod's all about, really, and the cultural and the history of it all. But so much, at least that's my goal, is to make sure that people want to have us come back. You know, we went to Huslia, we've been there twice, and the first year it was like the second coming of Christ. It was a Super Bowl, New Year's, Stanley Cup Finals, and people were saying, well, the other communities aren't excited. Well, we hadn't been going there for 50 years.
Right.
And it was the home of George Atla, of course, and the mushing mecca of all things interior, I'd say Huslia is, and those Koyukuk and all those river valleys and or river communities. So, yeah, it's a big deal. You know, we've never canceled the Iditarod.
Got close.
Been close, but I've always been able to figure out a workaround.
Right. And that was, you know, as you say, if it starts in Fairbanks, you're not on the historic trail for part of it.
Oh, yeah, and that's a big deal. For me personally, I want to make sure we run on that trail. You know, let's say you're a rookie in Iditarod and you want to run the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Fairbanks has been wonderful. They totally open the doors to me. What do you need? Anything? We'd love to have you here. But yet they realize that if you're running your first Iditarod, you want to go over the Alaskan Range. You want to see where the history is. You want to go over that original trail. So it's strictly a backup for us.
Right.
For sure.
And are there things still out on the trail that are historic? I mean, are there old buildings? You mentioned signage.
You know, we don't. It's more just the terrain. You know, we talk about how did these gold miners ever get down what we call the steps coming down onto the Happy, go over to the Squint and come up. Most of them are in ruins. You know, so you're more picturing, realizing that the old roadhouses were a normal day travel by dog team. Where then you'd have a dog barn and you'd pay so much per night for dogs and a meal and a bunk and to get those dogs inside. So there isn't a lot of stuff that's still there. Flat, of course, is such a iconic. I've only flown over it. I landed one time on the runway in the middle of the winter, never got anywhere to look at it. But so there's still a few places there.
And Iditarod.
And Iditarod itself. You know, we spent a lot of time there. I actually built a big cabin there that our mushers and any casual users can use. Realizing that southern route, when we leave Ophir, heading over to Iditarod, and then from Iditarod to Shagluck, there's very few people travel that, except for the year that we go there. You know, when you go the northern route, go from Ophir to what we'll call Cripple, and Iron Dog calls Poorman, their checkpoint there, on the way to Ruby, that's traveled, well, for sure the sled dog, or the dog, snow machine race goes through, so more people travel that. So there's not a lot of traffic. We kind of open that up to, and then other people can use it and follow the race. And
well, yeah, and it made me think about, like, Ophir to Ruby and you know, Nikolai McGrath, those areas. The people in the villages continue to travel back and forth and keep the trail open just by using it?
They definitely do once you get to the Yukon. There's not a lot of traffic. Some trappers and hunters and stuff, they may go out from Ruby back towards Poorman, Cripple, back in the direction of Ophir, and then, of course, to Cotton and McGrath. It's going backwards. But on that southern route, there's a few guys that'll go out. I mentioned earlier this big Yentna cabin out between Shagluck going back towards Iditarod, but not a lot of traffic on that Ophir to the historic place of Iditarod.
But
the other villages... Yeah, it's a highway.
Right, I mean, and then also like Kaltag, Unalakleet, all the way up to Nome. I think there's
always lots kids of basketball traffic. Tournaments going back and forth on snow machines between, you know, between Ruby and Galena and Nulato and Koyukuk and all the way through Kaltag to Unalakleet. Absolutely, they're traveled heavily.
Yeah, so that helps keep the trail open. You don't have to brush it out as much. Well, on the coast, you don't have to anyway.
But. Yeah, but no, definitely keep it. And a lot of local help. I mean, there's some bridges that have to be put in every year, leaving Kaltag and the Esmalka family and others in the community. They make it happen for me. So it's, and also Iron Dog benefits from that too, of course.
Yeah, I don't know about the bridges. Tell me about that.
Well, there's a few places, you know. The land is always changing and the rivers are changing, and there's a few places they have to actually drop some real big timbers across or cut some big spruce and plank them with brush and try to have them freeze up and everything. So it's definitely a lot of work.
Yeah, otherwise it would be a steep embankment down and back up.
Yeah, exactly.
And I can tell you by snow machine, you get stuck in those places.
Oh, yes, you can.
I don't know about with dogs, sure. But you know, I don't know if that historically were those kind of bridges put in.
I think so, you know, but there again, you know, different from my event, you're talking about running 5-6 dogs, maybe 8 or 9, not 16 powerhouse dogs. So it's a little different, too, with the equipment, and the sleds went over them in some ways even better because they were longer.
Oh, right.
And so they bridged those areas a little bit.
And then I don't know about when they used horses.
Yeah, a lot of, there was a lot, especially up Rainy Pass area, then they're still using horses for recreation and hunting up there.
Oh, they are?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the oldest, the Perrin's Rainy Pass Lodge is the oldest hunting lodge in the state of Alaska.
Well, I haven't thought about the, say, the other uses on the trail, like hunting. I mean, I know the recreational uses, mm-hmm. but do people use it as a launching point for hunting, or?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, there'll be people that they'll definitely hunt and trap outside of Caltag on the way out, and you get to McGrath, and they're going all the way, you know, back to Nikolai, and Nikolai to Takotna to Ophir, and Jesse Grady's a guide up there that helps me a lot with when I need to have the Ophir runway groomed. Jesse's a guy that'll, he's trapping out there and hunting too, and you know, all these families that have become so iconic, you know, the Forsgrens with their cabin at, right at Ophir there, that's something, they've been with us since day one, putting everything together, so there again, a lot of interest, and those people are interested in the history, you know, back to IHTA. I think that's what I hope I can do as I get a little more time here, is to try to not just hand out our pamphlets and tell them what's going on during the Iditarod, but try to spend time with them there and record stuff much like what we're doing here.
Yeah, well, and as you say, these families who have lived there for so long, they have their own connections to their section of trail.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No.
And I certainly, you know, trappers and everything, but I haven't thought about some of those old families.
Oh, yeah. And they and there's so much history there. I mean, I think of the Forsgren family, and, you know, they were instrumental. And then the Delias in Skwentna, you know, they were there from day one. And this is when it was just a dream, the event.
Right.
But they've been using the Iditarod Trail since they moved to this country.
Yeah. Have they talked to you about, you know, when the race first started coming through and the trail hadn't been really used.
Hadn't been used at all. And yeah, Dick Mackey and Dave Olson, a few other guys, they all, I remember my first trip in 76, they were talking about, well, is this thing going to go again, you know? I mean, it was, I think a lot of people thought it was a one and done. And that's the benefit to the IHTA, is that our race, you know, it's world famous, you know, and so it brings people, it has to work both ways in my mind. You know, they've been a huge help to me putting on the race because of trail work and the history and having this material I keep mentioning sent out to the villages, but it's also people get confused, like, IHTA, is that the sled dog race? No. And so, definitely not. I was able to go down to Tucson, and it was really something to be around all the, for a National Trails Conference. I'm going to San Antonio this year with Judy Bittner and Betsy Oliver, our executive director now, and just to be there with the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest and, you know, some major thoroughfares.
Yeah.
You know, compared to what we have here. So,
yeah, what happens at those National Trails Conferences?
You know, there's just talk about how we can, this year I think the theme is going to be protecting the trail. You know, there's everything from mining operations or you name it, you know, expansion of communities. You know, we used to run our sled dog race from Anchorage to Eagle River.
Right.
Well, you can't anymore because it's just developed too much.
Right.
And so trying to make sure that we keep this pristine area. I believe that it needs to be open to people that with respect. We want it used. That's the whole idea. We want to promote it, but we have to be very careful on how it's done.
And what about the southern part, which is potentially more used to say as a hiking trail?
That's been just a fabulous, you know, IHTA and with the Forest Service and the local club, the Seward Trailblazers, you know, that's a group that's been so active in promoting and getting the funding and getting the bridges and keeping, God bless Dan Seavey, keeping the Forest Service in line and the state and the railroad and DOT, you know, we're not going to lose this trail. And I think that's my, I look at, you know, I mentioned Lee and Dan Seavey passing on those, and, you know, I'm not that far behind him, but I want to keep that passion going. That's my chore.
I was wondering how it relates to this effort to have a long trail, because you mentioned the Appalachian Trail, Pacific Crest Trail, this Alaska Long Trail sort of fits in that.
Yeah, I think it's I think some people think people are competing for the dollars or competing for the funding and also notoriety and stuff. We just want people to get out and enjoy what we have. They need to see it. They need to live it. But I think IHTA is pretty settled in. And now that we have some, you know, a designated person that can help us go down the right path, you know, Judy Bittner has been just hammering this thing for years.
Yeah.
And she still is, you know. And I think that that's the key. I think you mentioned she was instrumental in getting this idea together, and that just shows her passion for history.
What about signage? Is there, you mentioned signage and, you know, in some point, you know, interpretive signage about history in certain places. Is that a plan?
Oh, yeah, it's started already. Kevin was good enough, Mr. Keeler. You know, you go to McGrath, you go to the museum, you go to... or even the Iditarod Trail Cafe, you go to Uniclete at the airport, there's wonderful signage just saying mile 827 of the historic Iditarod Trail. And, you know, you get so many people, and that's not just during my event.
Right.
I'm talking about summertime, fishermen, tourists, families. They're at the airport killing time, waiting on a flight, and that perks their interest. So that's something that has to continue.
Mm-hmm. And what about... installing markers? You said in some places that's hard, and I know out of Nome they do the tripods. And
yeah, we have tripods there. We help. That was a good thing. That was kind of a, dealt with three different groups, IHTA, the Nome Kennel Club. Two of our board members were really instrumental in, with help of Aaron Burmeister, Stephanie and Kirsten got a whole project together working on the Nome Kennel Club cabin, but also getting tripods after Murbach went through and devastated that whole coast. And so, and they also actually, well, there were more people. There was there's a shelter cabin that was built with IHTA funds, and that was dealing with the community of White Mountain. They built the cabin. They were maintaining the cabin. The old cabin wasn't usable. It glaciated over every year. I thought I could get into it in a storm one time, and you couldn't even open the door.
Wow.
So those are things that, you know, these different groups, I think that's what we're looking to do. It's our partners, you know, trying to get, I consider Iditarod a partner of IHTA. That's what we're looked at. And so you bring all these other groups in, too, so... That's kind of the plan. It's good.
Okay. Yes, your alarm has been going off, so I think are we at your time limit?
We got a couple more minutes, but only five. I'll tell you what. Why don't we?
Let's wrap it up.
Yeah. Well, I'm really sorry.
No. That's okay.
It just worked out that way.
I'm glad it worked out that I could stop.
At least
a little
get started, and now we can continue.
Yeah, and let's just wrap it up. Anything else you want to say about why you continue to be involved with IHTA and why it's important? And
yeah, I think my original interest in IHTA after Greg Bill passed away, and I was asked to take that position. When I first came up here in 1976, my interest was the North Rural Alaska communities, the history of it. I've never been that competitive a person by heart. I love teaching it, the art of sled dog racing. I think for me, it's just been a continuation of being able to pass that word on, keep that history alive. Yeah, I'm very fortunate. It's a fun bunch to work with, and I think as long as our federal government can keep putting money towards this, we'll make it happen. And with new help, with that new position I mentioned, Betsy Oliver, I think we're really on the right track.
Okay. Well, we will leave it at that for now. Maybe okay. We'll do more later. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I keep apologizing, but
nope, that's
it just
fine.
So happens.